The Guardian.
Hello, this is Lindsay Irvin for The Guardian Books podcast. One morning in 1908, a young Jewish immigrant in Chicago attempted to deliver a letter to the city's chief of police. The policeman proceeded to shoot him dead. How and why this happened remains uncertain, but it seems very unlikely that Lazarus Averbuch was the murderous anarchist he was reported to be at the time. This death is the starting point for Alexander Hemon's extraordinary new novel, The Lazarus Project, built around an imaginative reconstruction of the shooting and its tragic aftermath, along with the parallel story of a young Bosnian writer, Brick, who is himself trying to write about these events a century on. Hemon, who is also a Bosnian immigrant into the US and has, unlike his hero, won huge acclaim for his rich storytelling and spikily vivid English, started his interview by explaining how he had found this still-resonant American tragedy.
Actually, I went for a research trip with a Guggenheim Fellowship, and I came across this book called An Accidental Anarchist by Walter Roth and Joe Kraus, which is a small historical account of the Lazarus Averbuch affair and its aftermath and reaction to it in American public. And it's a really interesting and well-written, well-researched book. But it also contained these two photos of Lazarus dead in a chair, which I found then, as I find them now, absolutely amazing and astonishing in their cruelty and the gloating of, you know, the police captain behind the dead Lazarus and the sadness of this young man in a ragged suit and torn socks sitting in a chair being exhibited as a safely dead foreigner.
The photographs are incredibly important to this book. It's structured around a series of photographs from the archive and also which you took with a friend of yours took during a research trip to those Eastern European countries. Why did you structure the book around those?
Well, I always wanted photographs in the book. And once I saw the Lazarus photos, I wanted to have a book in which they could feature. And then at some point after that, I wanted to have a character who would be a photographer. So when we went to Eastern Europe, my friend Velibor Božević and I, he took about 1,200 photos. Some of them he took simply because he takes photos as a photographer. Some of them we sort of imagined what Rora would see and what kind of photos he would take.
Yes, and they're there without any commentary. And the curious thing about photographs is that, or the curious paradox is that they are incredibly vivid and they seem to open very directly onto reality that's gone. But they also... They say that picture tells 1,000 words, but they leave that the past opaque. Was that something you were thinking about?
I was, and it's also, Velibor Božević is a very close friend of mine. So close that we often do and think the same things without even talking about it. And I've known him for many, many years. And he's a kind of photographer who likes to photograph absences, if that makes any sense. That is, when you see his photo, you imagine what's outside of it. It is this that is interesting and appealing.
I wonder that the other parallel story, as well as the reconstruction of Lazarus Averbuch's tragic death, is the story of Brick, who is pursuing a similar fascination to yours with Averbuch. His situation as a Bosnian who's making a home in Chicago, who's a writer and who receives a big grant, a gloriously known Glory Foundation grant, to trace that story, does chime in conspicuous ways with your own. I'm curious to know why it feels right to structure your stories around lives which so clearly mirror your own.
Well, it's a reasonable question. On the one hand, this is my working method, and I discovered this working. I start from a personal space and then expand outwards, as it were, into other people and other times and other spaces. And so that personal space is, I guess, marked by the presence of someone who superficially resembles me. But there's also a kind of a problem of a sort. What if I made him Polish, you know, say not a Bosnian immigrant? Or if I made him a refugee from somewhere else, say from Kosovo, you know? And what if I made him not a teacher of English as a second language, but say a computer designer or software designer? I mean, what difference would that make? You know, I would have to make someone who's entirely different from me. So rather than busy myself and worry about avoiding similarities, I just let them be there and then work with them. And not to turn my book into some sort of concealed confession or, you know, or a false memoir of a sort.
Right, so you want to lay bare the fact that it's a fiction, it's an imaginative journey which you're taking from a
particular time and place.
And so, and then, you know, if people really care about those things, they would notice that there are so many differences between me and my character. But it also marks, for me, the domain in which I work and write. It is marked by memory, history, and story, or storytelling, if you wish. And they're continuous in my mind, in my language. And so try to take memory out of it, you know, would mean that I would take myself out of it. Or to try to take history out of it, I would also have to take myself out of it because I'm so defined by this history. If I start taking out those things and pursuing difference, as it were, making myself into someone else, so God forbid somebody might think that, you know, it's me, it's an entirely different project. So I just let it lay there, and then hopefully, you know, people will be able to transcend it and see into what is beyond that. So on March 3rd, 2004, I was seated next to Bill Schuttler, the man who was clinking against his empty beer bottle with a dessert spoon following the regular and even rhythm of the dance. The patriotic people of the organizing committee wanted me to impress Bill and his wife with my writerly success and personal charm, since the Schuttlers were board members of Glory Foundation and thereby controlled all kinds of glorious funds. Both of them were in their 70s, but Bill seemed fully fit for death, what with his hips replaced, the indelible age blots on his face, and an urge to acquire a comfortable condo in eternity by spending his money charitably. Susie was not ready for the infinity of Florida. She had the voracious curiosity of a college junior. She showered me and my ego with questions and would not relent. Yes, I read those columns in English, I said. Yes, I think in English, but I also think in Bosnian. Often I don't think at all. No, my wife is not Bosnian. She's American. Her name is Mary. Yes, I did speak English before I got here. I have a degree in English language and literature from the University of Sarajevo, but I'm still learning it. I was teaching English as a second language, and the reader asked my boss to recommend someone who could talk about the experience of the newly arrived immigrants. She recommended me, so I've been writing the column since. No, it is not called at the home of the brave. It is called in the land of the free. I don't teach English as a second language anymore. I just write the column for the reader. It doesn't pay much, but a lot of people read it. I am hoping to write about a Jewish immigrant shot by the Chicago chief of police 100 years ago. I stumbled upon it while doing research for my column. I'm applying for grants so I can work on my book. No, I am not Jewish, neither is Mary, nor am I Muslim, Serb, or Croat. Well, I'm complicated.
I don't want to push this too far, but one another thing you do have in common with Brick is trying to build a new life in America. And I remember interviewing you some years ago and rather lazily describing that experience as exile, which was a term you were very keen not to use.
Because exile, to my mind, means, not being able to connect or reconnect with wherever you came from, culturally or personally or emotionally. Or politically, you know, Solzhenitsyn was in exile. He could not go back. They would have killed him. And apart from the few years when there was war, and, every time after the war, I want to go back. I did go back, and it was not seen as someone, you know, who had lost connection. And so it also, I went out of my way, so to speak, to maintain those connections. I write in Bosnian and publish in Sarajevo continuously, a column in a magazine called Dani. In Sarajevo, I stay in touch. It matters to me. So, you know, my past has not been erased. And even now when I go to Sarajevo, it's not a nostalgic encounter. That is, I do not walk down Sarajevo streets and think how, you know, I used to be young and what beautiful times those were. But rather engage with it as it is now. It's a place in a bad shape. My friends are older and some of them alcoholics. And, you know, but it's what it is now to me. It's not just what it used to be. So exile does not describe my situation, but also it does not, the implication of exile is sort of some sort of nostalgic fantasy.
That said, the meaning of home is a central concern of the book. And it's at its most excruciating in the story of Olga, I suppose, Lazarus's sister, who has any kind of roots just torn away from her. Her country is torn away from her. Her brother's torn away from her. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the meaning of home in the story in general.
Well, one of the leitmotifs in the book is that they say, various characters, that home is when someone notices your absence. And when I wrote this initially, It does seem still as an accurate definition. But then I realized that, you know, home as defined by your absence from it, you know, has much more complicated implications. And I realized that in some ways it works that way for me, as much as I consider Chicago my home right now because my family is there and I have settled there. And yet I feel it more as home when I'm away from it than when I'm there. And Sarajevo, it is my hometown, you know, but when I go there, I have a tenuous relationship with it as home. It is my old home, as it were, you know, as though I'm visiting my family after I moved out, except I have no family in Sarajevo. Home is, I guess, if it's a state of mind, but it's an evanescent state of mind.
Yeah, but also one of the less material things people make their home in is language. And I wonder, in terms of home, you've been writing in English since the early 90s. Is it a language that you feel fully at home in now?
In fact, the way I feel it is that English is at home in me.
Right.
In the early 90s, as I was absorbing English in a way that would allow me to write it, I realized what was happening was that it was entering my subconscious mind to write in any language, including your native language. The language has to be part of your subconscious mind. And obviously, your native language enters your subconscious mind when you are two or so, even before that it starts entering it. But for some reason or another, the English language entered my subconscious mind mainly in the early 90s. I'm not sure why and how it happened, but it did. And as an example, a couple of examples, I remember dreaming in English and noticing in my dream that people who were not supposed to be speaking English were speaking English. And more weirdly, I remembered in English things that could not have taken place in English. And the way I understand it now was that my subconscious mind was sort of being translated into English. My memories were being translated into English, you know, my dreams.
Mm. And your own experience to some extent? I mean, you're feeling sort of less, more English-speaking and less Bosnian than you...
No, well, at that time I did, and it worried me because I thought that this, you know, would necessitate the erasure of Bosnian, but it didn't. And once I started writing again in Bosnian, there was a time, about 3 years, when I didn't write in either language, and I was worried about it, but I started writing in Bosnian, it all came back, I mean, very quickly, within a day. So it did not erase anything. It just, you know, doubled up. And so I contained both languages. They're both at home in my head.
Right.
It's a vast head. You can put furniture in it.
Just to get back to the book again, that follows Brick's attempt and the readers and your own to recover the lost experience of Lazarus that's been obscured by history still. But the book is also full of reminders how uncertain any kind of reconstruction is always going to be.
It is necessary, it seems to me, to have access to history, to be able to experience it or re-experience it. To understand it as part of your life, or to understand yourself as you live now as part of history. But for this to be possible, you have to see yourself in a continuum of history. That is, you have to connect yourself with the experiences of other people in history. This is a moral, an ethical, and a human obligation, and also a need, I think. And, you know, people are disinclined to do so these days for whatever reason. And so how do you do that? That is, what stories do you trust? How do you reconstruct what is out of your reach? History is in some ways inscribed in language, but only in particles and randomly.
Do you collect... And there's also the sense within that history that you show in this book by reproducing news reports, fantastically slanted news reports of how Lazarus died, which showed how all the stories we tell tend to be inflected by the ideology of a particular age.
And many of those are actually, you know, pretty much verbatim quotes from the press of that time. But then I acquired the style, and then I wrote quite a few more in that, you know, mode of reporting. And I enjoyed it immensely, that writing in that, you know, discursive mode.
And those prejudices which are reproduced in the way Lazarus's death is reported are also echoed by the way the Americans in the story misunderstand what's been going on in Bosnia. And the wider world in general.
Yeah, the Americans or the American public has changed in many ways, but some things stay the same. And in that regard, perhaps they're not different from, you know, the British public or the Bosnian public in some ways. But there's this need to see the other, a foreigner, as dangerous. And it's a need that is produced and then maintained by powers to be. It is much safer to see others as external and much more fruitful for the building of the nation to see others as, you know, this permanent danger.
And the parallels between the hysteria and Lazarus's time over the menace of swarthy anarchists and the paranoia driving America's war on terror are explicitly drawn in this story.
They are indeed. There were changes in the immigration law. I didn't put it in the book, which are much like the immigration law changes in the United States these days. The way, if you replace the word anarchist with the word terrorist, some of those statements by officials, which I ran into reading for the book, they could be transposed verbatim, you know, and put in the mouth of, you know, Bush administration officials or local anti-immigrant activists and whatnot. It's really amazing. It's sort of a constant in American political life because there was so much immigration in America, and immigration has been constant, even if the numbers changed. It was reflected in the rhetoric of people. It is not that it happened, which it did, obviously, and it's easy to find it, but it is impossible to imagine it not happening. America, the way it cannot exist without immigration, is history. It does not exist without history of immigration. So it does not exist without history of anti-immigration. You know, those things, they work together. It is nearly impossible to constitute American identity without immigration and anti-immigrant sentiment. And this is, every once in a while, this is, you know, rekindled by some sort of patriotic rhetoric magnified, as it has happened after 9/11. I remember today talking to someone. There's this inane speech or half speech that Bush gave in Iowa in 2000. This is well before 9/11. But he said something, you know, when I was coming up, there was us versus them. But now there's no them. We don't know who the them are. But we know that they are out there. It's just, it's hard to quote this because it's completely asinine. But it's exactly the ideology of, the far right wing or the right wing in the United States pre and post 9/11, and, you know, the 1908 patriots and anti-immigrant activists.
We see how that ideology obscures the truth of what went on in your book. But there are alternative perspectives on that. I mean, there's another important character, the photographer Rora, who seems quite unconcerned about the objective truth of the stories he's telling. There are a lot of great stories.
Well, Rora, I think of him as an epic character, epic in the sense of a Homeric epic poem. That he has completed himself. That is, his storytelling is not a self-fashioning project. He does not, you know, talk about how he became who he is or how he could become someone else, which a lot of, unlike Brick and unlike a lot of contemporary fiction or the characters in contemporary fiction, he's like a Homeric character who's telling about his adventures, but also the adventures of others. And he, storytelling for him is not a self-expressive activity. It is a storytelling activity.
You say he's complete as a character. He's not.
Right. He does not develop. Mm. In a sense. So his stories are not about his development. He's not striving toward a better self, nor are his stories...
Or to find the truth in a way other people are much more worried about.
No, and consequently he has no interest in the development of other people. They're just characters in a story. And, you know, much like the heroes in a Homeric, in the Iliad are who they are, and they do not
pass
become
in and out of his
different
life and provide a bit of local
And that's
color.
The exactly opposite from Brick, who's a navel gazer. He talks about his doubts and his, you know, self-fashioning. And so they're two opposite poles of the narrative range. Olga cannot send a letter home until the proper burial, unless Kaddish is said. They will dump him into a hole in the ground like a beast. Will they even put him in a casket? Will they wash him, or did they leave it to the rain? Will the Polizei kick his corpse into the grave? Will they piss into it? She leaps out of her chair and makes two steps forward, one step back on the shards. The forks and knives in the cups clink and crackle. The noise makes her furious. She grabs a fork as if to stab someone, but then stands with her hand half raised, the spikes of the fork pointed at the darkness. The rain is cutting against the window pane. In the far corner, In the deepest darkness, something watches and listens. Dear mother, there's no good way to say this. Lazarus is no more. No, nothing. Dear mother, it seems we can never escape grief. We have lost Lazarus. What have we done to deserve so much suffering? Her dress reeks of doleful sweat and policeman cigars. Her stockings are torn. The heel is broken on her left shoe. He cried when he lost one of the calfskin gloves he received as a bar mitzvah present. Lazarus in his silly boy sailor suit. He used to be afraid of sparrows. Lazarus at the bar mitzvah, reading from the Torah, haltingly. Why does the Jewish day begin at sunset? Lazarus teaching a stray dog to fetch in the refugee camp in Chernivtsi. The dog watching him with confused disinterest. And then the way he pushed his ears forward with his fingers and jutted his lower jaw to look like a monkey. The depth of his laughter when Mr. Mandelbaum did his tricks. An egg would disappear then reappear behind Lazarus's jug ear. He refused to acknowledge the first gossamer on his chin. The taste of his curls when she kissed them, sweet and salty, sometimes bitter. His cold face in the morgue. No heartbeat in his chest, nothing. Dear mother, your last letter made us so happy. We're more than fine. I have a new job as a legal secretary, and Lazarus is working for the Hebrew Voice as a reporter. He's contemplating getting married.
The story tilts back and forth between raw tragedy and high comedy, which is a style common to all of your books. I wonder why that seems the right way to address the material of your story.
I could justify it theoretically, but it's primarily...
It's just the way it comes.
It's a sensibility, yes, and it's my sensibility, but it's also... it's not uncommon in Eastern Europe and Bosnia. Nabokov said about Chekhov that he wrote sad stories or sad books for humorous people. That is, you could not see their sadness unless you had a sense of humor. And in Sarajevo, this is how people often approach telling the stories of their experience. When I went back to Sarajevo for the first time after the war, people would tell me their siege experience, about their siege experience. And they would tell me about them as stories. And they would, they would tell a funny story how you wash yourself with a 2-liter Coca-Cola bottle and then use that to flush the toilet, and how you have to develop a skill, and then how a whole family, the whole family lived together, about 10 of them, and they had nothing to eat under siege. And then somebody one day brought in a potato, a single potato, shriveled and small. Of course, they could not feed all 10 of them or anyone with that potato. But because they had not seen a potato for a very long time, they put a potato in the middle of the table and then they sat around and watched the potato. And this was told to me as a funny story. They're roaring with laughter. And of course, when you parse it, when you think about it, it's a horrible story. I had nothing to eat. And, a potato was a miracle. It was told
but
to me.
But it is also, absurd and told in the...
And if you can laugh about it, it means you have survived,
And there's some distance achieved.
And there's this instinctive reaction to all that a lot of people I know, it's inscribed in the sensibility of people who have experienced that kind of history, I think, and I carry it around too.
Another feature of the book is the continuing presence of in Bosnia of people who did pretty well out of the war through violence and crime, and that the country is, that part of the world is still in quite a mess. I wonder, do you feel encouraged about the future for the country by the fact that the authorities have got around to arresting Karadzic recently?
Well, yeah, and as happy as I was when I saw that he was arrested, he was arrested because he has no power base or influence. He was just a criminal on the run. And I would not have been surprised if it's discovered that he was sort of... The Serbian authorities stumbled upon him and then they had to arrest him.
Oh, really?
I cannot claim
Mladic,
this. Mladic, maybe they were looking for Mladic. Maybe they were not looking for him at all. But in any case, he was arrested because he was disposable. He had no power, had no control, and had no money to share around. And so that's why. So his arrest, it has largely a symbolic value, which is good, but far from enough. And the fruit of his works, the part of Bosnia known as Republika Srpska, a statelet born of genocide, is still there. And, the people who are one way or another Karadzic Karadzic's heirs. They're running part of Bosnia. They're part of the government of the country that they try to eradicate. And that, you know, has not been addressed or redressed in any way. In fact, I worry that Karadzic's arrest would coat this fact into some sort of, you know, moral triumph, that now we don't have to worry about Bosnia and what the actual state of things, because Karadzic could be tried symbolically.
Just one final question is, your last book was presented as a novel, but you weren't comfortable with that description at the time, and you were reluctant to define what you were doing in any way. I wonder, are you comfortable with this book being described as a novel?
No, this is a novel, yeah. But I would not refer to it as a novel until I submitted the manuscript. I called it The Big Book. I just could not describe it as a novel. But then it wasn't obviously a short story, because in some ways a book has to earn its right to be a novel. And it, you know, it was only at some point that it congealed into a novel. But, you know, it was very hard for me to say this. The previous book, Nowhere Man, was never labeled as a novel. Not never. On the hardback, the original publication in the United States, it did not say a novel or short stories on the cover. It was subsequently elected as a novel, and I let it go.
Does that feel like an important milestone for you as a writer, that you feel you have written a novel? Or does
it's a big thing. It's like, you know, building a cathedral. Now we have to wait to see if it'll crumble.
Alexander Hammond, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.